London responds again today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. After an attack on worshippers leaving a mosque, London's mayor rejects religious intolerance.
One of the things that these terrorists hate about us is whether you're a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, a Hindu, a Buddhist, a Sikh, a member of an organized faith or not, you're accepted for who you are here in London.
Also, Portugal battles huge forest fires that are being fueled by the dry bark of eucalyptus trees.
Strips of bark fall off and are very flammable, and then they then get pushed by the wind. And that's how the fire spreads that quickly.
Plus, just how important is cricket for Pakistanis?
Cricket is the blood and heart of our nation. We are so excited when we win, and we're so devastated when we lose.
And today, they're very excited. That's stories ahead and more here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. It happened again last night, again in London, again a van driving into people. Here's London Mayor Sadiq Khan earlier today.
Our police and others are working their socks off, working around the clock. You will see additional visible policing over the course of today and the next few days. Don't be alarmed. They're there to keep us safe. One of the things that these terrorists hate about us is whether you're a Christian, a Jew, a Muslim, a Hindu, a Buddhist, a Sikh, a member of an organized faith or not, rich or poor, old or young, you're accepted for who you are here in London.
This attack was different from previous ones, though, because it appears to have targeted Muslims. It occurred in an area of London called Finsbury Park. Police believe 47-year-old Darren Osborne drove into a crowd of worshippers leaving a mosque. 10 people were injured. One man died at the scene, but it's unclear if his death was related to the vehicle attack. My BBC colleague Leo Hornack knows very well that part of London where the attack occurred.
I actually live in Finsbury Park, pretty close to this, where this all happened. So it's an area that's very familiar to me. And just a couple of hours ago, I went back there and I spoke to a gentleman called Yassin. He works in a travel agency and he was there. He was one of the eyewitnesses. Here's what he told me, Marco.
I was there. Love injured. A lady, a man's old man, broken arm, legs. We try to help injured people. We try to call the police. Police has been come late, 20 minutes. All the community come and they catch the man. He tried to run. I was helping the injured people. A lot of things happened. I was, up to now, I couldn't sleep. Shock.
So that's Yassin. He was an eyewitness to this attack. Do we have any idea why this community center seems to have been targeted, Leo?
Well, it's a Muslim community center. That's the obvious immediate motive for someone who is motivated really by religious hatred. But beyond that, it's not making an enormous leap to say that the Finsbury Park Mosque is one of the most famous mosques in Britain. And in the past, many years ago, really, it had a certain reputation nationally. There was a famous preacher, extremist preacher called Abu Hamza, who preached at the mosque. This is going back around a decade. Mm. And so it was a place which became featured in tabloids a lot as synonymous, really, with extremism in Britain. Now, it has to be said, Abu Hamza is long gone from there, and the community and the mosque management have been at pains for many years to say that they put that in the past, and it's a very different management and a very different tone that is struck in the mosque today.
So when you went to Finsbury Park earlier today, what kind of reactions were you hearing from people you spoke with? Like, what did people you spoke with think had happened last night, and why them?
I'm afraid to say this, Marco, but there's an air of resignation almost. And that goes whether you're Muslim, Sikh, Christian, or none of the above. There's a tradition here of when there's a time of great national tragedy, a minute of silence is observed across the whole country. And that's something that used to happen once or twice a year, but we've been having them almost every month, almost every week, it feels like at times. We had a minute's silence today to commemorate the victims of the Grenfell Tower fire that I was talking to you about last week, which is completely unconnected to this. It's not a terrorist attack, but it's the same feeling of a nation united in grief. It's almost as though this country and London in particular can't actually keep up with the speed of horrendous pieces of news that are coming at a pace that no one is really used to.
So four terrorism attacks in Britain since March, seemingly all attackers inspired or weaponized by ISIS until this one. This attack would appear to be an attack on Muslims. Where has this taken the mood in London?
Well, let me give you a short example as a way of answering that, Marco. At about 1 a.m, so about half an hour after this happened, I woke up. I was woken up by the sound of a helicopter circling overhead. And my first thought was, I wonder if that's a terrorism attack. That's not the kind of reaction I would normally have to hearing a helicopter in London. And that, speaking to my neighbours around Finsbury Park and speaking to people in the shops really even closer to the attack, that's the same kind of mood. People are disgusted, they're horrified, some are afraid even, but no one felt this was a surprise.
Our man in London, Leo Hornack, thanks very much for the update.
Thank you, Marco.
London's Muslim community is also dealing with last week's deadly fire in a 24-story apartment building. At least 79 people are now thought to have died in the Grenfell Tower fire, and police say the death toll could rise still. The fire took place in one of the city's most diverse areas, and my BBC colleague Mark Mardell has been meeting Muslims who are helping survivors deal with the aftermath.
We're here trying to provide support as much as we can in terms of meeting their immediate needs for the families that have survived and are here and evacuated.
Latifa Begum talks with crisp passion, but 3 days working at the Westway Sports Centre with victims of the fire have taken their toll. She's so tired and emotionally pummeled. A volunteer for a coalition of Muslim charities, she says the victims' needs are not now physical ones.
As a response unit, we've been working with emotional support services, going out to help the families that have been very much traumatised by this tragic event.
Is the council doing all they can now?
I think the council definitely can do a lot more in terms of providing support to these families and working with charities.
I've just been handed a leaflet by a little girl. I haven't read it yet. It says, "I can't sleep. The children's screams are in my head. We owe it to them to ask all questions. The media and the government has its sacred cows that it does not question, but we must."
A box of boys, and we have
a
boys' box?
Well, no, but we opened it, but it's full up.
We can open another box.
Yeah, we can open another box.
Or I can make another one.
On the first floor of the Al-Manar Mosque, a group of women are intent on sorting donated clothes into cardboard boxes piled high all around the room. This was where many of those made homeless slept for a few nights. They've all gone now, but the mosque is very busy, a hub for help. Khatija Sakrani is a volunteer lawyer who's organised a meeting for victims of the fire.
The need on the ground is immense. There's a short-term need and there's a long-term need. There's a need for housing, there's a need for food, there's a need for mental health care, there's a need for someone to tell them what's going on.
I imagine there are a huge number of legal issues, but what are the main ones you want to deal with first?
So what we expect to happen here is that there will be a team of lawyers who will deal with immediate housing issues, burial issues, immigration issues, because we have family members who need to come into the country to bury their family. We have family who want to repatriate bodies overseas. But then there's the long-term goal as well. And the long-term is responsibility, ensuring that whoever was culpable is to some extent brought to justice.
The chief executive of the international charity Muslim Aid, Jahangir Malik, is more used to working in Syria than West London.
When I go to disaster zones all around the world responding, we expect chaos, we expect mayhem, because there's poor infrastructure. I think the level of chaotic response from all parties of not knowing who's doing what here is something that I didn't expect here in London. I was flabbergasted as to where we are at in terms of the flow of information, the coordination, so that we can just get it to the families. I know that's easier said than done. I just, not saying anything is just absolutely hurting the people.
You said you've got the material needs, the food and the clothes that you need. Indeed, I saw a notice as we entered the mosque saying, no more donations, please. But if there's one thing you could get agreement from government or whoever, what do you need?
I think we absolutely need empathy with the people that have been affected, and we need leadership. Someone, somewhere, some group has to be in charge, because we're not in a faraway country run by conflict and war, and there is no infrastructure. That's just not the case.
Jahangir Malik of Muslim Aid, ending that report from the BBC's Mark Mardell. Britain isn't the only country dealing with a deadly fire. In Portugal, raging forest fires in the center of the country have left more than 60 people dead. The country's prime minister calls it the biggest tragedy for Portugal in decades. Paul Ames is a freelance reporter based in Lisbon. So, Paul, how contained is a fire at this point?
The fires are not contained at all. The fires are still raging. The firefighters are working around the clock. Many of them have been working for several days now without a break to try and contain those fires. But they're still raging in several fronts across the central part of the country.
Can you describe this part of Portugal? Is it wilderness, mostly forest, with some settlements?
Yeah, I mean, there are isolated settlements there. It's an area which is mostly planted with forest. A lot of it is eucalyptus forest. It's not a native species to Portugal. It's used to feed the paper and pulp industry here, which is an important part of the economy. And it's got isolated villages, many of them inhabited by older people. And they were really caught by surprise by the speed of this fire, which hit many villages and also people in their vehicles, in their cars, driving through the forest.
Do officials know what causes fire?
They suspect that it was caused by a lightning strike. There was a terrible combination of weather factors on Saturday, very high temperatures, gusting winds. Winds were unpredictable, coming from different directions. And there was lightning. There was no rain, but there was lightning. And they think a tree or some undergrowth was struck by lightning, and this sparked the fire, which then spread very fast, pushed by those winds.
Yeah, apparently eucalyptus trees have pretty flammable sap. Is that part of the problem? Are they just burning out of control and they can't stop that?
The eucalyptus are very flammable. Their leaves are very dry, and they have this kind of flaky bark. Strips of bark fall off and are very flammable, and they get pushed by the wind and spread the fire. And they burn very quickly, and that's how the fire spreads that quickly. I mean, one of the most tragic parts of this were 30 people, more or less half of those who were killed, were just caught in their cars as they drove through a forest road. The speed of those fires were just so fast, just caught people unawares.
I heard some encouraging news about 12 people who survived a fire blazing through their area by hiding in a water tank. I'm just wondering, how are people in Portugal dealing with this, considering it's kind of unprecedented?
Yeah, the country's in deep shock. Forest fires are not an unusual occurrence here. There are fires every year. We had terrible fires last year on Madeira Island, for example, where 3 people were killed. But something on this scale is really quite unprecedented. The president made an interesting comment last night when he addressed the nation. He said, you know, it's a time of immense sadness, but also a time of resistance and combat. There has been a huge outpouring of national support for those firefighters. People are going to nearby towns, bringing them food, bringing them water, and also donations. People are donating. Rich people, poor people are donating to help rehouse those who have lost their homes. I mean, dozens of people have lost their homes. They've lost everything in this fire. And people are donating to try and help them.
So good to hear about the charity and goodwill, but is there concern in official circles how they will actually get this fire under control?
Yeah, there's immense concern. I mean, neighboring countries have been sending help. There are planes from Spain, from France to Italy, those planes that suck up water and dump it on the forest. But unfortunately, the scale of these fires, the amount of smoke and the unpredictable nature of the wind is really hampering those efforts. It's really making it difficult for the planes to get in close to the fires where they need to be. But there was some hope this morning. There was some rain this morning. There was a short showers brought some hope that maybe the weather would turn because it's still very hot and it would limit the flames. But it hasn't really put too much of a brake on the blaze for the moment.
Reporter Paul Ames speaking with us from Lisbon. Thanks very much and good luck.
Thank you.
Coming up, Pakistan makes 338 for 4. India collapses to 158 all out. I don't know what that means either, but stick around. We'll find out together. And I promise you it'll be more than numbers and wickets here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. A couple of sports stories for you now. In a moment, why cricket means so much to Pakistanis, especially today. Don't worry, we won't try and explain the game to you. It's just a chance to talk about a major change in the fortunes of Pakistan's cricket team. First, though, a big change that's being tested in soccer. The sport has long resisted the use of technology to review calls on the field, but now it's trying it out. We're talking about the so-called video assistant referee being used this month in the Confederations Cup tournament in Russia. The World Soccer Guy William Troop is on the case, so explain how this system called a VAR would work.
Well, it's pretty simple. There is literally an assistant to the referee who is on the field. This assistant is in a booth, either in the stadium or nearby, and the assistant is looking at the feed from TV cameras all over the stadium to check on the decisions being made by the referee on the field. It is limited in its use in that it can only be used in four specific situations. When there's a call that relates to whether a goal was scored or not, a call as to whether there was a foul that should result in a penalty in the penalty box, when someone is given a straight red card, so was it warranted, and for some very rare cases where the referee gives a red or a yellow card to the wrong player, like the player who did not commit the foul. So those are supposed to be the only four situations in which this technology can be used.
Who makes the final call, the person watching the screens or the referee who asked for the kind of decision-making?
Well, it's all supposed to stay in the hands of the main referee in the middle of the field.
All right. We've seen numerous calls get quite close and quite controversial. What are the downsides and the pros of this?
Well, the downside is merely that it's messing with tradition. And the soccer purists out there think that anything that slows down the game, that keeps it from flowing smoothly and quickly, is a detriment to the sport. Because soccer has always been a sport that flows for 45 minutes. There's a halftime, and then it flows for another 45 minutes. There's very few significant pauses in the games. But really, the upside is that, you know, referees are human. They make mistakes. And for the first time, they are submitting themselves to a little bit of video review to catch those mistakes.
So it's kind of getting this test run, this beta run of the Confederations Cup in Russia. Is it successful?
Well, that's just the thing. So far, the tournament is in the early stages. Four games have been played. In three of those games, the VAR, the video assistant referee, has been used. And it's successful in that every time it's made the right call. I mean, they have the video evidence. It's hard to make the wrong call at that point. What is less successful is that there's confusion on the field because players and coaches and even spectators are not used to this happening in soccer. Literally, you know, the action stops and the referee is listening to his earpiece and nobody knows what he's hearing. And suddenly there's a change in the decision. So players in particular have been confused by this.
And for the soccer purists who say, you start that clock, let 45 minutes go, we reach halftime, no stoppages in between. How much time was lost to review the videotape?
In my experience from the couple of games that I've watched, not that much. Basically, you know, it stops for 30 seconds. The video assistant referee gives his or her recommendation, and then the call is made, and off we go.
So it's being used at the Confederations Cup right now in Russia. How likely is it that we'll see it in the World Cup in Russia?
I think it's 50-50, and chances are getting better at this point.
The World's William Troop, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
If you have any friends or co-workers from Pakistan, you probably have already heard about it, the stunning, spectacular victory over arch-rivals India in a sport that is like a religion over there. Some would say it is a religion. I am talking about cricket. Pakistan crushed India in a surprise victory in the final of an international contest called the Champions Trophy, taking place in London. Journalist Beena Shah is in Karachi in Pakistan. So, Beena, put it out here. I don't understand cricket, and your job here is not to explain it to us. It's a sport the Brits love to play, and so it's traveled the world over. Wherever the Brits had colonies, cricket wasn't far behind. What I want you to explain, though, is the excitement in Pakistan. I mean, Pakistan won this Champions Trophy, but why is this win so, so spectacular?
Well, cricket is the blood and heart of our nation. We are so excited when we win, and we're so devastated when we lose. This particular tournament, we were not favorites to start with. We were actually ranked eighth. So to see us actually win the entire thing was like a dream come true. It's being described as miraculous in some corners. And it took place during the month of Ramadan, where we're fasting and it's an extra holy month for us. So there were many, many, many prayers going up at all hours of the day and night that we should perform well, and our boys, our team, didn't let us down.
Right. So it was also against arch rival India, which is important. And I don't understand the rules, but apparently there were a record number of runs.
That you could put it that way, but it's real. Cricket is really about the performance of the batsmen as well as the bowlers, much like baseball. You know, it's about the pitching as much as it is about how many home runs you make. So to watch some of these really stellar performances, beautiful performances by some of these young cricket stars who had been unheard of before this tournament, to watch them mature throughout the games and to watch the team peak at just the right moment to bring home the trophy was like I said, a dream come true for all of us.
What kind of reactions were you seeing on the streets where you live?
ecstatic. And typically in Pakistan, when there's a win like this, people take to the streets with guns and let loose rounds of celebratory gunfire, which actually killed about 7 people in the country.
Oh my gosh, really? So the contested region of Kashmir somehow plays into all of this, because I was seeing tweets from Pakistani fans in Kashmir, and it seemed like the cricket match for them was a proxy event in some ways for the standoff over Kashmir. Am I right?
Well, cricket has taken on political overtones over many years, and especially when you have arch rivals Pakistan and India playing against each other, it becomes very much a test of each nation's power, virility. These people are our chosen gladiators. They go and fight in the ring for us. So emotions run high, and I think a lot of overtones that are political, they're made in the heat of the moment. They're not things that you would actually want to encourage in terms of diplomacy.
The Champions Trophy was played at the Oval in London, which is kind of like the Vatican for some cricket fans. But two teams, India and Pakistan, battling it out on the turf of the imperial power. Are those optics just part of the deal in 2017, or do they still strike some people as kind of odd?
Cricket is an international sport. It's played everywhere where the British were, and it's gone to countries such as the Netherlands when we were going through the match when we'd won. Even countries like China and Turkey tweeted their congratulations. So it's really one of those sports that is just loved by many, many, many people all over the world except Americans. And to see India and Pakistan, you know, former colonies of the British, actually having thrown the English out of their own tournament on their own home turf, was very satisfying to many of the diaspora. And the English took it in good spirit and actually settled down to watch what they call really cracking cricket.
Mm. As you said, this was the holy month of Ramadan, still is, so kind of a spiritual victory as well. And then the attack later in the evening, seemingly on a mosque in Finsbury Park in London. Did you hear reaction in Pakistan to the kind of contrast of just that unbridled joy that Pakistanis were feeling?
You know, winning this tournament was a great morale booster for us. We've been through some very unstable times. There's a lot of instability in the world. And I think these are just good reminders that there's so much more that unites us than divides us. That's a quote from Joe Cox, the British politician who was murdered right around this time last year. We need to remember that cricket is a great unifier. As much as we enjoy the rivalry, we do tend to realize that we have so much in common, and it's a shame to fight over things and throw away this great camaraderie and this great brother and sisterhood that we have.
Beena Shah, thanks very much, and go Pakistan.
Go Pakistan. Thank you, Marco.
I'm Marco Werman, coming up on The World.
A lot of these white supremacists believe that they're really under attack from immigrants, from ISIS, and that they need to sort of protect the white race.
And so some of them have turned to a religion rooted in Northern European mythology, named for the Norse god of war. More on Odinism, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It seems the United States is wading deeper into the war in Syria. Here's what we're seeing. Over the weekend, a U.S. jet shot down a Syrian warplane. The White House calls it an act of self-defense after claims that Syria had been attacking U.S.-backed troops on the ground. For its part, Damascus says the U.S. has no right to be involved in the war there at all. So I asked the Associated Press's Philip Issa in Beirut, who are these U.S.-backed troops in Syria?
So the troops on the ground are predominantly Kurdish local forces that the U.S. recognizes as being the best equipped to fight the Islamic State. So the U.S. has backed them in their pretty broad campaign to push the Islamic State out of northern Syria, where they're hoping to establish their own autonomous, again, predominantly Kurdish zone. But the U.S. is actually quite highly invested in that campaign. I mean, I said that they're backing them, but the reality is they've also got military advisors on the ground. So certainly when the Syrian government jet targeted the Kurdish forces, there's little doubt in my mind that the Americans would have felt threatened.
Was that the intent of Bashar al-Assad sending this jet over to this part of the country? Was he sending a message to the U.S.?
Yes. I mean, it seems like he is. This is the fourth time in the last month that Assad has gotten too close to the Americans, and certainly it seems like a pattern, like he's trying to show that he is a sovereign of Syria and he has a sole right to decide who can be in Syria and who's not.
Now, we know the U.S. has been providing air support for its coalition partners on the ground and launching missile strikes on ISIS. How often does the U.S. shoot down, like, Syrian government jets?
Well, it's the first time that the U.S. shoots down a government jet. But since the Trump administration has come into power, they've attacked Syrian military positions or sites five times. Once was after the chemical weapons attack in northern Syria. I believe that was in March. After that, there were two incidents where the U.S. struck Syrian ground forces in eastern Syria that it said were approaching too close to its local partners. Once when it shot down a drone, we're not really sure to who it belonged, but probably to Iran or some other government backer. And then now we have this shoot down of the jet.
And now Russia, which is seemingly an ally of Bashar al-Assad, says it's going to target U.S. aircraft west of the Euphrates after the U.S. shot down the Syrian jet. What are the potential ramifications of this warning from the Russians?
I mean, the ramifications are potentially large, but it's still difficult to parse how much of this is bluster and how much of this is real. It's certainly not in Russia's intent or in anyone's intent to start, you know, World War III over this incident. But they did suspend what they call their deconfliction channels, basically channels where they decide with the Americans who flies where over Syria. So they've escalated the possibility that there could be a misunderstanding or a confrontation because they basically closed these back channels that used to be used to smooth out conflicts. But they have suspended those deconfliction channels before. Mm-hmm. And a few weeks after that, they resumed them. You know, again, I think it's a question of looking at the larger picture.
If we step back, we see the U.S. being more active in Syria right now, but running into problems that President Obama was keen to avoid. So are these all lessons of what happens when you get more deeply involved in Syria?
Yeah, I mean, Syria is a hornet's nest. And if you do one thing here, if you pull a string here, you don't know what's going to happen somewhere else. And so the U.S. is entering into a very, very complicated war, and it is at risk of getting entangled in something larger than its stated objective. You know, its stated objective is to defeat the Islamic State in the north, but that's also the stated objective of the Syrian government, of Russia, of Iran. And so it's almost inevitable that with everyone on the surface going after the same thing, that they're going to run into some trouble with each other.
It feels like the last few weeks and certainly the last few days, we're entering a new phase of the war in Syria. Do you see this conflict escalating?
It's hard to say, but you're definitely right, I would say, in your diagnosis. It does look like we've moved on to a new phase. The first 6 years of the war, we could describe it largely as a war between, you know, a sitting president and a deeply unhappy population, an uprising. But this has now become a geopolitical war where we have Damascus, Washington, Moscow, Tehran, and to a lesser extent, Ankara in Turkey, and the Kurds all vying to stake out their claims of whatever the post-uprising Syria is going to be.
That's the AP's Philip Issa in Beirut. Philip, thanks very much.
Thanks for having me.
Last month, Emmanuel Macron scored big in France's presidential elections, beating far-right candidate Marine Le Pen. And yesterday, Macron solidified that victory. His party, La République En Marche, or Republic Onwards, won a sizable majority in the French parliament. Marine Le Pen's National Front only garnered 1% of the vote. Here's my BBC colleague Lucy Williamson in Paris.
Il est 20h. Voici le nouveau visage de l'Assemblée nationale à l'issue de ce second tour. Confirmation.
2 months ago, this result would have stunned France. More than 60% of parliament won by a party that a year or so ago didn't even exist. The only surprise today is that they didn't win more. Proof of how much Mr. Macron and his party have already reshaped French politics, Prime Minister Edouard Philippe gave his reaction.
Ce dimanche, Vous avez donné une majorité.
Today, you have given a clear majority to the president and the government. The majority of French people have preferred to choose hope over anger, optimism over pessimism, and trust over fear.
In the northeastern town of Hénin-Beaumont, the far-right Front National was also celebrating, even though early results gave the party around 8 seats, half what it had been hoping for. One of those seats, crucially, went to their leader, Marine Le Pen, who, after years serving in the European Parliament, will enter France's national chamber for the first time.
Face à ce bloc!
In the face of this party, which represents vested interests, in the face of this beast of the system, copiously fed by every media and financial house in our country, we are the only force of resistance to the dilution of France, of its social model and of its identity.
Never before has a French political party won such a stunning majority from scratch. Big enough for Mr. Macron to push forward with his bold and controversial Labour reforms. Big enough even for him to weather the inexperience and diversity of his new MPs.
We have some red lines we don't want to see crossed by the government.
But with around 200 seats shared among a divided opposition, some are asking where real political pressure will come from. Didier Hott is a leader for one of France's biggest unions, Force Ouvrière.
If you want to discuss, if you want to compromise, you must put something on the table. And for the moment, he has nothing to put on the table but to say you are going to work more and you are going to be paid less or with no more than today. The match is just beginning. If he will succeed, he will have to cope with us, and it will be a fight. Who wins? I don't know. We'll see.
The sweeping victory of President Macron's party hides a more complex national mood. Turnout today was just 43%, the lowest for decades. And while many voters wanted change, most did not pick Emmanuel Macron as their first choice for president. His new elected army has been drafted quickly. More than half have never served as politicians before. Having swept away the old political order, they're all under pressure to deliver something new.
The BBC's Lucy Williamson reporting there from Paris. There's an ancient Nordic religion called Odinism, and it's captured the attention of some white supremacists here in the U.S. They call North America Vinland, wear pendants with Thor's hammer, and believe they'll be taken to Valhalla if they die in battle. Since 2001, white supremacists in the U.S. have carried out, or at least planned, at least 6 acts of domestic terrorism in the name of Odin, including a stabbing in Portland, Oregon, last month. Will Carlos is a reporter with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. Explain what Odinism is, Will.
So technically, this is neo-Odinism. So this is kind of a new rebirth of an ancient heathen religion that was practiced mainly in Scandinavia. And essentially, this is the belief in the broad pantheon of Nordic gods from Odin and Thor and Freya. And you believe that they sort of led their lives in the correct way. And you try to emulate that during your time on Earth. I think that's the best way I can kind of sum it up.
And in the U.S., there are some parts of the country that are kind of more inclined toward Odinism than others, right?
Yeah, these guys sort of exist in these disparate groups around the country. It's very popular, actually, in the Pacific Northwest. I mean, we mentioned the horrible stabbing in Portland. There are big groups, especially in the prisons up there, who are organized Odinists and white supremacists. And it's also prevalent elsewhere in the country. There's a big group in Virginia and also across the Midwest. We have to be very, very clear that we're talking about sort of a racist strand of heathenism. This is just a group that has kind of co-opted this religion for their own purposes. And it's a minority of the total group.
Well, let's just find out a little about the kind of characters who are part of this. Tell us what you've learned about the Portland attackers' ties to Odinism.
So this was bizarre because I came out with a big investigative story that I've been working on for months. And the very next day, there was this attack in Portland. And I started to research this guy's past. And I started to see things on his Facebook page that really caught my eye. For example, he had pledged to kill either Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton, whoever ascended to the presidency last year, in the name of Odin. He had also written a bunch of poems that specifically referenced Odinism, Odinist myths and imagery. And I actually contacted a friend of his via Facebook and had a long conversation with him. And he told me that Jeremy Christian, the stabber, had become very involved in Odinism in prison.
How has this whole belief system around Nordic gods and Nordic mythology kind of found its way into the world of white supremacy?
So this is a really fascinating part. And I've talked to a bunch of white supremacists at this point who converted to Odinism, and they've all given me basically the same path. And what they say is that it's twofold. They say, number one, Odinism is a religion that is both by and for the white race. So it's not a religion, and this is their words, not mine, it's not a religion that has been sort of interfered with or mongrelized by Jews. And a lot of these white supremacists obviously are extremely anti-Semitic. And they don't like the fact that, you know, Jesus was a Jew and that ultimately Christianity came from Judaism. And they sort of figure that out along the way and say, oh, let's go and find something else. And then the second part is that Odinism, by and large, rewards people for action. It rewards people for dying in battle. That's how you ultimately get to Valhalla, is you die in battle. And so a lot of these white supremacists believe that they're really under attack. They're under attack from immigrants, they're under attack from ISIS, and that there's a white genocide going on, that they need to sort of protect the white race. And frankly, they don't agree with turning the other cheek and sort of sitting around and waiting, you know, for the second coming or whatever. They want to get to work and fight. And that's something that Odinism very much promotes and rewards them for. So that's why a lot of them are attracted to it.
I mean, it sounds kind of like a form of jihad. Do they see martyrdom at the end of the line?
Absolutely. I mean, that's what got me interested in this in the first place. I talked to a guy who's in prison serving 21 years for domestic terrorism, and he had planned to bomb sites in Boston and in DC. And he very much was doing it in the name of Odin. He got out of prison and he decided that his way to get to heaven was to go and kill people in the name of his religion. And he used the word jihad. He said, look, this is a jihadist point of view. There's definitely correlations there.
Now, since Odin is a god from Nordic mythology, I'm wondering how prevalent Odinism is in Norway, and is it spreading across Europe?
I've been contacted by a lot of Norwegians, people from Iceland, saying, look, you cannot tar us all with the same brush because this is a very legitimate, almost mainstream religion in parts of Northern Europe. So yes, there is certainly a lot of this Nordic mythology that goes on. A lot of people are interested in this religion. But as far as white supremacy, there's much less that goes on. That seems to be sort of something that's really taken root in the States.
How do the FBI and other law enforcement agencies here in this country see the white supremacist link to Odinism? Is it a serious threat in their eyes?
The experts that I talked to, and I talked to a guy who was the head of domestic terrorism in the Department of Homeland Security for more than 6 years, and he sees this as a very real threat. Bear in mind, these guys see any threat as a very real threat. It only takes one of these guys to plant a bomb and kill a lot of people. But more than that, they see it taking root right now in the Trump era, and they're really worried that it's not being focused on and paid enough attention to. That, frankly, people are paying so much attention to Islamic terrorism that these other forms of terrorism, particularly with the religious base, are being sort of forgotten and left behind, and that's something that really concerns them.
That's Will Carlos, a reporter with Reveal from the Center for Investigative Reporting. You can read his full report on Odinism at PRI.org. And before we take a break, the United Nations has proclaimed tomorrow World Refugee Day. Across the globe, many refugees are still school-age kids. And reporter Lauren Holt has been looking into the challenges they face. Tomorrow, she'll be online between 1 and 3 p.m. Eastern to answer your questions. To find out more, visit The World on Facebook. A cyber attack via text message. That's what the Mexican government is suspected of doing to some of its critics using advanced spyware technology. The software is called Pegasus, and the Mexican government bought it from an Israeli cyber arms manufacturer called the NSO Group. But there was one condition for the sale, that Mexico would only use the software to investigate criminals and terrorists. But according to a New York Times report out today, the technology was used to spy on about a dozen people who have one thing in common.
They all take very sort of strong stances against the government. They're all pretty strident in their criticism.
That's Azam Ahmed. He's one of the New York Times reporters who wrote today's story. I asked him how the software works.
They send you a text message, essentially. It's usually tailored to you. Maybe something that involves you, something involves your company. And if you click on the link, it downloads the software, and that software then basically takes over your phone. It can turn on your microphone and listen to your conversations at any point. It can turn on your video camera and film you. Encrypted messages mean nothing. If you use Signal, because it's inside of your phone, it can monitor essentially every message that you send. So it kind of turns your phone into a personal bug.
Wow, that's not good. So who ended up by getting targeted?
So two of the most famous journalists in all of Mexico, Carmen Aristegui, Carlos Loret de Mola, and a lot of people who worked with Mrs. Aristegui on investigations that involved the president. In addition, three prominent human rights attorneys who represent the families of the victims of the 43 disappeared students.
The famous case in Ayotzinapa, Mexico.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. So the attorneys that represent them were all targeted.
So is what the Mexican government is doing with the software, is it legal?
So there are ways for surveillance to be legal by Mexican law. They need judicial approval, and there has to be some sort of a strong case made for why they're asking or requesting surveillance. Now, intelligence experts in Mexico that I spoke with said there's no way they would get approval to surveil prominent journalists, especially journalists who are critical of the government and don't pose a national security threat, or human rights attorneys, or anti-corruption activists. To be fair, the Mexican government has denied that they've done this. They've said that they in no way, shape, or form have monitored or surveilled these individuals. But there's a lot of counter evidence to suggest otherwise.
Do we even know how many governments around the world use advanced spying spyware or even the software made by the NSO group in Israel?
Yeah, the answer to both is no. We certainly don't know how many different nations the NSO group has sold their software to. The belief is that it's a small number, and they have said repeatedly that they vet very carefully the nations to which they sell their software. But by any metric, Mexico does not have a good human rights record. And so it begs the question, how then did you justify selling so much of it to Mexico? And then further, this isn't the first time Mexico has been accused of using malware. So back in February, my colleague had a story about how this same software was used to target the backers of the so-called soda tax, this initiative to increase the price of sugary drinks in Mexico because of an obesity epidemic here. Once that was, that information came out to the NSO group and we asked them and they had no response to us about what steps had been taken once they realized there was misuse of their software.
Is anyone policing this whole cyber arms industry?
That's one of the big questions and issues right now. The answer is no. There is no global body that looks at how these cyber weapons are sold to governments, what governments do with it. You know, in particular with the software, essentially the NSO group can't even police it. They have to rely on the government they've sold it to conduct an internal investigation and then turn those findings over to the NSO group. And if you're the kind of government that is going to misuse this software, the likelihood of you doing a robust internal investigation and then telling on yourself is even lower. So there is no global body that can kind of jump in and say, hey, how is this being used? I mean, there's no legal regime under which it falls globally.
Azam Ahmed is the New York Times bureau chief for Mexico, Central America, and the Caribbean. Thanks very much, Azam.
Thanks, Marco.
Finally today, remembering Monterey Pop. That was the big three-day open-air concert in Monterey, California, back in 1967, arguably the first rock festival ever. Yep, 50 years ago this past weekend. It was a gathering of folkies like Simon and Garfunkel and Laura Nero, and of pop music royalty like the Mamas and the Papas and Otis Redding.
This is the love crowd, right? We all love each other, don't we? Am I right? Let me hear you say yeah there! All right.
It was the Love and Peace crowd. The Who was there, and so was an American guitarist named Jimi Hendrix, who hardly anyone in the U.S. had even heard of yet. San Francisco was well represented, with acts like the Jefferson Airplane and the Grateful Dead. But there were also different sounds at the Monterey Fairgrounds that weekend. Ravi Shankar played, and so did a trumpet player from South Africa, who had recorded this tune with the Byrds a few months earlier. Hugh Masekela on horn. He hadn't yet recorded his big groovy hit, Grazin' in the Grass, but he was away from apartheid South Africa and relatively free in the U.S.
I was living in the States. I was living in Los Angeles. I was part of the music community.
And in Los Angeles, Masekela had formed that relationship with the Byrds, and David Crosby in particular. He also met music impresario Lou Adler, who set up the Monterey Pop Festival.
I had broken out in Los Angeles very big, you know, with the help of David Crosby and Lou Adler and other people who saw me at the Whiskey A Go Go. And at the Whiskey A Go Go, I think I was one of the first non-white musicians to play there on the Strip. And I became part of the California music community, you know. I became friends with the Jefferson Airplane, with like the Grateful Dead, and all those people were all friends. So I was part of the community, and I was pleasantly surprised when I was chosen for the festival. I didn't expect that.
We'll be looking more at the legacy of the Summer of Love in the coming weeks on the show. It had way more impact than launching some talented psychedelic bands and introducing the world to LSD. In the meantime, we leave you with Hugh Masekela's performance at Monterey Pop of The Healing Song, better known to South Africans as Bajabula Bonke. We have video of Hugh Masekela and his ensemble at the 67 Monterey Pop Festival performing this number. That's on our Facebook page. Just search for The World. From the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.